Curlew in Autumn, a thriller serial for radio in 6 episodes by Edward Boyd, with David Ashton as Peter Kalman. Episode 1.
Whatever they were waiting for was about to happen now. And suddenly I became aware of something. Something I hadn't noticed. Something that perhaps had not been there to notice. All of them, every last one of them, was carrying or wearing some kind of timepiece. Some had watches the size of pumpkins. There were watches in gold and silver, in porcelain and platinum, in metals hitherto unknown. Clocks of every shape and of every size except small. Clocks of astonishing ingenuity, and some as perverse as bad taste could achieve. One was haloed with seashells, another nestled in a miniature life belt, one doubled as the navel of some weird masculine fantasy, another was embedded in a dead man's skull. One old crone carried appropriately a grandfather clock. The village idiot, unwittingly non-conformist, proudly displayed a sundial. Suddenly, the crowd was silent, and there appeared a tiny man, stepping daintily from the doorway of his house, to be greeted by a cacophony of clock noise, bells, chimes, cuckoos, and buzzers. Get lost, whoever you are.
I am Magda von Schellenberg.
Never heard of you.
Oh, people don't speak to me like that.
Good almighty, it is 4 o'clock in the morning.
Not where I am.
And wherever you are is the center of the universe.
I am in New York.
Give my regards to Broadway.
Short, sharp burst of biography. On the office door it says in faded gilt lettering, Kalman and Kalman, solicitors. One of them is me, Peter Douglas Kalman. The other Kalman had his first and last coronary 2 years ago. He was my uncle. Anything else? Well, yes, I am. And yes, I did. I remember it all and how it ended. Face downward in the Twickenham mud. And I remember the man who did it. And for him, there is an uneasy room in hell. After 4 o'clock in the morning, the experts say things can only get better. I don't agree. After 4 o'clock in the morning, you only get 5, 6, 7, 8, and so on. The world gets lighter, but not on that account brighter. 9 o'clock? Breakfast survived, carbuncular porridge, cremated toast, washed down with an instant something, 9 o'clock, and off to the office, where a man awaited me, 40-ish, sturdy, shaved so close it must have been done from the inside, wearing thick tweeds that had been bought from a mail-order catalogue 20 years ago.
A fine morning, Mr. Kalman.
You're on the road early this morning, Jock.
Maybe draw a rain later on.
What is it, Jock?
I thought I would tell you myself.
Uh-huh.
I mean, a pride of you, see what I mean?
No, Jock, I don't.
I'm talking about the wife.
Well, there's nothing wrong with her, I hope.
No. She's right as the mail. It's just that... What I'm trying to get round to is that... she'll no be coming back.
Back to work, you mean?
Aye, just so.
Well, I thought she was quite contented.
Oh, she is. She is. You mustn't blame her.
Well, there's no question of blame involved.
I've been idle now these 2 years. And they tell me it's no as bad as it was in my father's day. I think it is, Mr. Calman. Every bit as bad.
At least you don't have to starve nowadays.
When I married Mary, there was nothing in the bargain about her keeping me.
So that's it.
That's it.
Some folk might say you're being a bit selfish.
Mary and me have been into all that.
Then there's nothing more to be said.
I've no right to say this, Mr. Calman.
Say it anyway.
Mary thought you might no be sorry to see her go.
What put that into her head?
She says it might help having one less wage to pay.
She dreamed that up all by herself.
There's a rumour going around that you're having a bad time financially.
He would say no more, but shortly afterwards took his clumsy leave and clumped out into the morning street that smelled of last night's frost and today's new bread. I sat there, helping nothing to happen. 'Twas all as exciting as watching cow dung harden. Nobody called to invite me to appear on This Is Your Life, or to breathe heavily at me, or to explain to me why Mary should suddenly desert the sinking ship, and who had mentioned to her that the ship was sinking. You could feel the morning freshness wear off like make-up, and the early silence was raped and raped and raped again by the heavy lorries pounding along the A75 to Stranraer, trying not to kill too many people on the way. And the farmers' wives had come to town, and the supermarkets screeched with shopping trolleys, and the licensed grocers were doing a land office business, and it was time for my appointment at the bank.
Mr. Anderson will see you in a moment.
What is he doing?
Mr. Anderson...
Feeding sugar lumps to the computer?
Mr. Anderson...
Call him Piggy. Everybody else does.
Well, everyone else doesn't work for him.
You could be wrong there.
You can go in now.
Thank you.
Mr. Anderson was my bank manager, and there was nothing wrong with him that death wouldn't cure. We'd been at school together, and there were other things we once had in common, like Alice Watson name, who used to go to church with him on Sunday mornings, and to extreme lengths with me on Sunday afternoons.
Ah, good of you to drop in, Peter.
Come off it, Piggy.
I wish you wouldn't call me that.
No?
Especially...
With my overdraft, was that what you were about to say?
Especially in front of my staff.
Can I do it behind your back?
I can't stop you.
Can you stop yourself?
What does that mean?
Jock Matheson came to see me this morning.
Well?
He more or less told me I was broke.
He more or less told you the truth?
Yes, but where did he hear it?
His wife works in your office?
Mary has worked for me for almost 10 years. She wouldn't have lasted 10 minutes if you hadn't been trustworthy.
Could we discuss this overdraft
of yours? Just let me say this first.
If you must.
Mary's husband has been out of work a long time. The chances are he'll never work again. That doesn't stop him hanging round the cattle market the way old boxers hang round the gym.
I'm afraid...
And so you bloody well should be. You're not averse to hanging round the cattle market yourself, Piggy.
Business takes me there, occasionally.
And you can't talk business all the time you're there, can you?
You know how farmers love to gossip.
Only too well.
I'm not going to discuss this a minute longer, Calman. To begin with, I haven't the time. Secondly, you have already made up your mind that I am responsible for what people are saying.
Well, aren't you, Piggy?
What do you intend doing to reduce this overdraft?
He was a smooth customer, in the way that rocks can be smooth. And when we parted frostily, half an hour later, he took my checkbook and my credit cards, but allowed me to keep my contempt for him and my conviction that I was getting the best part of the bargain. The town's main street was swarming now with people. The shops blazoned forth, each its heraldic smell. Warm and yeasty from the bakers, from the ironmonger, the crucifixion smell of nails. The garden shop held suspended the scents of next year's spring, and from the Church of Scotland bookshop, the sour, bleak odour of sanctity. And high above them all, yellow and bright and cold as the November sunshine, the stink of money, everywhere. Except where I was,
in my small oasis of near bankruptcy. So I made my way back to my office, where a visitor awaited me on the stairs, a very old visitor, and very unexpected.
Your girl seems to be out.
Sorry about that, Mr. Hansford.
Do you mind if I step in for a wee while?
Oh, welcome.
Place hasn't changed a bit.
Aye.
Does your credit, Peter? I thought it does.
Are you sending me up, Mr. Hansford?
Not me, Peter, not me. My worst enemy would never accuse me of having a sense of humour.
And what can I do for you?
Aye, 23 years since I last set foot in this office, Peter. Hasn't it changed a bit?
The occasional lick of paint.
Man, I like that, Peter. Shows a proper respect for your uncle's memory. None of this modern carry on turning a man's place tops or teary for the brace properly out his body.
Mr. Hansford.
Ah, you're going to tell me you're busy.
Wrong.
I'm glad you're prepared to do me the favour of no insulting my intelligence. You see, Peter, it's common knowledge that the firm of Kalman and Kalman hasn't been busy, in any meaningful sense of the word, this long, long time.
We get by.
Ah, man, that sounded just like your uncle.
Is that bad?
You manna put words in my mouth, sir. I held your uncle in great respect. Best judge of a horse I ever met.
Except maybe in a betting shop.
Ah, well, Peter, you said it, no me. Mind ye, I wouldn't altogether disagree with ye. A ken a wheen a wheel dane men took their business away from your uncle because he aye seemed to be at Lanark races when they needed his advice.
Well, maybe he figured they should do their own dirty work.
Us lawyers can't afford to be fakey. Did there no used to be a painting hung up in that mantelpiece?
I took it home.
The insurance folk would insist likely.
No, I was just fond of it.
I admired that painting. Oh. Gin you were ever...
You'll have the first refusal.
There'll be no refusal. I can promise you that.
He was right there. It's difficult to refuse what will never be offered. The message seemed to get through to him, and his 80-year-old eyes went curiously blank, and he made a strange, non-committal noise in his throat and went shuffling off, as though trying to erase his footsteps in case somebody had followed him there. In anybody else, it would have been persecution mania. In old Hansford, it was the way life had taught him people were. Life and the law. After he'd gone, leaving behind him the strange, dry smell of age, a smell like leaf mould, I sat and thought about him. The word was getting round about the parlous state of Kalman and Kalman's finances. The word was getting round, and the vultures were gathering. They were still gathering when the phone rang. Peter Kalman?
Well, you sound brusque.
That has to be Jenny Oliver.
How did he know?
Who else would pronounce brusque the French way? So, what do you want? My company or my skilled professional advice?
Both, perhaps. Tell him more when I see you.
Which will be when?
About now. Ciao.
Ciao. Everybody loved Jenny Oliver, but Jenny loved nobody. Or more accurately, Jenny loved everybody, and when you love humanity, restricting yourself to a single human being seems a curious kind of meanness. Jenny loved causes, so maybe she had a point. Can you imagine Joan of Arc hanging out nappies, or becoming a pillar of the PTA? On the hour, prompt as prompt, there she was.
Well, as the unemployed bishop said to the Pope, long time no see.
You make that up all by yourself.
Oh, Lord, does it sound that bad?
Yes. Where are we going?
The Spencer Watson Memorial Hospital. To see a friend of mine.
Anybody I know?
Don't think so.
A relative, lover, or just the usual lame duck?
Lame duck.
But not very lame.
What do you mean?
The Spencer Watson's a private hospital.
Go on.
They don't take your pulse there, they check your bank balance.
Tim hasn't got a bank balance.
Who the hell is Tim?
I'll tell you about him in the car.
The Spencer Watson Memorial Hospital was 8 miles from the town. 8 miles of the most beautiful country you ever coveted. Its architects were fashionable and Finnish, and a minor royal had laid the foundation stone, which was almost as thick as he was. The staff were reputed to be the most highly paid in Europe, which didn't mean they could keep you alive when that old democrat Death had made up his mind that you were it.
Tim.
Hmm?
You, promised to tell me about Tim.
Oh, so I did. Tim's a hermit.
That's fine as far as it goes, which isn't very far.
He's Welsh.
How do you know?
Because he practically lives on labour bread.
I can see I'm going to have to treat you as a hostile witness. Where does he practically live on labour bread?
Dungrennan Bay.
Oh. Oh, so that's Tim, is it?
That's Tim. He lives in a shanty, built from driftwood.
Didn't the local rag write him up about a year ago?
Yes, he was furious.
Yeah, he was right. Who ever heard of a front-page hermit? So, Welsh, hermit. What else is Tim?
Age about 60, middle height, no visible scars.
Means of support?
None particularly visible.
You, talk to him a lot?
Quite a lot.
Ever mention his background?
Never. If you've any romantic notions about him really being Lord Lucan, forget them.
Not Spencer Watson material?
Definitely not.
So, what makes you think he's there at all?
A note from him on their tasteful, expensive writing paper.
Anything alarming in the letter?
Not in the actual letter.
About you, find it rather curious.
Tim could neither read nor write. He was totally illiterate.
The Spencer Watson Memorial Hospital lay to the left of a long and attractive stretch of road that seemed to have its own private climate. The sun always shone here. Flowers probably bloomed out of season and always ended up looking like orchids. We passed through gates that looked as though they were made of gold, but might not have been. The receptionist was a kind of masculine dream-made flesh. She seemed to have more teeth than were necessary for anything except aphrodisiac purposes, and her smile made you realize why sunglasses had been invented.
And whom do you wish to see?
Did you say whom?
Oh, doesn't everybody?
Oh, God.
We'd like to say hello to a patient here.
Name, please?
Mine or his?
His.
Tim Layton.
And to what doctor has he been assigned?
Do you remember, Jenny?
No, but it won't crack a bloody nail varnish to find out.
Jenny?
Perhaps you and the lady might care to wait in one of the waiting rooms.
You can bring us 2 gin and tonics while we're waiting.
Jenny, for God's sake.
We went into the waiting room, the one with the David Hockneys on the ivory-coloured walls and the carpet that looked like a transmuted blood transfusion, but only if your blood was blue. There were little tables bearing magazines printed on glossy paper that looked expensive enough to be used as currency. Everything evoked a sanitized world where no one belched or sweated or broke wind, and it obviously evoked in Jenny a desire to do all 3.
Yuck!
She's only a girl doing her job.
Oh, the 20th century alibi.
Well, she is.
I'll tell you what she is. She's a failed Miss World.
Your prejudice is showing.
Peter,
I'm afraid there's been some mistake.
I didn't think mistakes were allowed in a place like this.
Well, we're only human, after all.
Could I have a second opinion on that?
You, said there'd been some mistake.
We have no patient here called Layton.
We drove back down the avenue, past the flaring rhododendrons, imperial and purple. Once, a peacock strutted across our path and fixed us with a beady patrician eye as we gave it right of way. Then we passed through the gates of gold, and Jenny spoke.
She was lying.
Hmm?
Miss Herpes, 1984, she was lying.
And why should she do that?
Because somebody told her to.
Oh, come on, Jenny.
Right pain in the arse she was.
Yes, I think you made that quite clear.
You notice anything?
I noticed that you never mentioned the letter from your illiterate friend.
Good for you.
And you're going to tell me now why you didn't.
Because whoever wrote that letter may be someone who's still inside the hospital. And if that's the case, it might turn out to be important one of these days.
I pulled the car into a lay-by, beside a concrete bin that was jammed with the debris of picnics past. Redundant Coke tins, broken thermos flasks, plastic bottles, orange peel, dead magazines. And I sat and looked across the landscape. And a curlew cried its cry of incurable grief.
Why have we stopped here?
I want to talk to you.
What about?
The day the world ended.
A bit premature, aren't you?
Depends on whose world we're talking about.
Whose world are we talking about?
Ours.
Did we have one?
Yes. And could have again.
Are you suggesting we take up where you left off?
I wouldn't exactly have put it that way, but yes.
Bed and all.
Oh, for God's sake, you make me sound like something Hemingway wrote.
I'm sorry.
You saw what happened to me.
Was that the day the world ended?
Yes.
Pissy little world.
Pissy little me.
I didn't say that.
You didn't have to. It's a conclusion I arrived at all by myself.
Bully for you.
Is that all you can say?
Self-pity always embarrasses me.
Someone has said that we have art in order that we may not perish from truth. In a world where both art and truth are manufactured commodities, this strikes me as one of the most dangerous and foolish and irresponsible remarks ever made. I had learned my truth the hard way. In a humiliation of helplessness and occasional despair and futile anger. It was not much of a truth, not magic, not universal, perhaps not important, except that it was the only truth I had. A truth arrived at painfully in a hospital bed. We drove back in silence and parted like the strangers we'd suddenly become. I climbed the stairs to my office and sat there for an hour, watching the room reflect the pointlessness of my life. And then the telephone rang, and my morale immediately guessed a wrong number. But my morale was wrong.
Is that 4419?
It is.
Have you the Gaelic?
Have you the right number?
Hang up and switch on your answering machine.
I did as I was told and sat back, thinking about the voice. Highland, obviously, both from what she said and the way she said it. But apart from that, why, where, who, when, and all the other interrogatives. I lined them up and let them wait for 30 minutes, keeping them company. Then I switched on the machine to hear what I had. I sat, playing it back, over and over again, as though mere repetition would unlock its secret. Then I did what I should have done in the first place, and telephoned Donald MacLeod. He was one of our three news agents, and voted SNP, and came from Stornoway. He arrived at the office within minutes, and listened several times to the message, and gave me an old-fashioned look.
And what have you been up to?
Just translated, eh?
Who's the bird?
Bonnie Prince Charlie.
No way. She was Polish.
Translate, Donald. Translate.
They lied to you about the old man. I am unhappy about him. Mm-hmm. I need your advice. I am going to see local hero tonight. What's that all about?
It's a publicity stunt for a movie. The little cinema opened at 6, and at 6 I was there, parked opposite its dreary frontage, and feeling like a cross between a private eye and a boy in a blind date. Would she show up? Who was she? What was the advice she needed? Why was she unhappy about the old man? 2 hours dragged past, and I was beginning to relive that adolescent sense of outrage and anger and frustration when someone tapped on the car window. A beef-fed face stared in as I wound the window down. Liquid blue eyes the colour of ancient denim, slack mouth like an old and empty purse. Constable Archie Douglas, the local policeman.
Waiting for somebody, Mr. Kalman.
Am I not allowed to park here?
Would her name be Morag Nicholson?
It might be.
She's at the Spencer Watson Memorial Hospital.
And what's she doing there?
She's in the mortuary.
In episode 1 of Curlew in Autumn by Edward Boyd, Peter Kalman was played by David Ashton. Jenny was played by Stella Forge, Magda von Schellenberg by Vivian Dixon, Old Hansford by Ian Stewart, Constable Archie Douglas by Robert Patterson, Jock Matheson by John Shedden, Nurse Nicholson by Anne Cullen, the bank clerk and the hospital receptionist by Tamara Kennedy, and Piggy Anderson and Donald MacLeod by John Buick. Curlew in Autumn was directed in our Edinburgh studios by Patrick Rayner.